I'm actually going to start actually with my big picture messages first before going to my slides. And the first thing is I actually want to answer the question, are we making progress? And I want to give you just a little bit of my down-home example, which is I've been waiting to ask this person to marry me for 20 years. And in the last 4 years, that person finally said yes. Okay? And right now, all that we're worrying about right now is planning the wedding. And what I mean by that, what I'm saying is that we've been asking for the things for our community for years and years now. And in the last 4 years, you've gotten data disaggregation. There's a policy in HHS. And that's one of the big things that we've been asking for, data disaggregation. There's a policy now, and they're actually collecting data now. And the fact that Alex is up here presenting data that's specific to Native Hawaiian, specific at that granular level, the partner just said yes, all right? We've been asking for health care access, health insurance, all right? Affordable Care Act is in. And unless something happens in the next couple of weeks, we can count on this for our community. All right. So everything that I want to be talking about may be sort of like planning the wedding. We're not, the marriage is going on, you know, you're just planning the wedding. The second thing is she wanted me to encourage people to, you know, do more healthcare workforce work. And I'm like, you're motivated enough. You're here, you know, you're missing lunch to be here. So what can I tell you that's going to be helpful to you? So the number one thing I want to tell you is it's really important, whatever you're doing, to get involved in policy. All right. It will jazz you up. It will give you the energy to go to do your daily work, but it also allows you to really expand the range of effect that you have for your communities. The take-home homework for all of you is if you don't know who is the person running the health insurance exchange in your state, you need to find out who that person is. You need to find out when they're meeting, and you need to find out a way to get to that table. If you're an individual and you can't get yourself to that table, you got to get your community together so you can get to that table. All right, because all of this is now planning the wedding, right? It's either going to be, you know, shotgun wedding in Las Vegas, or it's going to be, you know, the nice little Asian, no, traditional Asian wedding with 600,000 people or whatever it is. It's up to you, though. You got to decide this, right? So if you're going to just let this go, this is the opportunity that you're letting go in the next couple of years. So you got to do this. And then the last thing that I think is really wonderful is health is going to be a growing field. They're going to be jobs. You're in the right field. Make sure other people in your community are thinking about this field. There are a lot of people from your community who never consider a career in health, health care, health research, health policy, any of that stuff. Because they don't have any role models, you can be the role model. Go get them to do it, all right? Now, let's get into the meat of the talk. I was charged to talk a little bit about the White House initiative. Daphne mentioned a little bit about it, but a lot of you don't quite know exactly what it is that we do. Review briefly some of the data on the workforce diversity, and then show you the Health and Human Services healthcare workforce plans. So the White House Initiative API, this was actually, most of you probably know, was established in the late 1990s by President Clinton, sort of went into quiescent for 8 years for reasons that you already know, and then it was reestablished in October 2009 by President Obama. The initiative is really wonderful because it's a cabinet-level access to the president for AAPI. And access and relationships mean a lot in terms of getting things done. The co-chair is Secretary of Education Arne Duncan and Chris Liu, who is also cabinet secretary. Our executive director is Kieran Ahuja, and we have an advisory commission with 20 members. I am not the most famous one, Heinz Ward and Apollo Ono. I just wanted to show you what we do, which has actually been very confusing. So, confusing to me when I first started in this job. So, the initiative has a strategic plan, which is right in the middle, all right? And how we form the strategic plan is really through community recommendations. You know, we are very community-based, community-engaged. And the initiative staff has done a lot of work to get information back from the community about what it is that it wants for various different things within the government, not just health. And then the initiative works with the commissioners to really get, you know, good validated information. And then we then work with the federal agency through their agency plans to implement these recommendations. The plans then are brought back to the community for feedback. And so you can do this loop. So every year we review it and we give them back their feedback how they're doing. So this is really the core of our work. We do a lot of community engagement. This map, I thought someone was going to show it, but no one did. So This is a map of population centers of AA and HPI in this country from the census. And the point to make there is that we're not just where we think we are. There are a lot of us in other places now, in the middle of the country. Just met a woman from Iowa who said she had a lot of Asians in her city, and she didn't know what to do with them. So, we went everywhere. As a matter of fact, I didn't go everywhere. Daphne did, and the staff did. They basically held over 200 events in 25 states, reached more than 27,000 people. The point being is that we are very interested in soliciting your input, and even in this meeting, please give us your input. No need to worry about this except in the middle. It's a little bit small, but the four things in the middle there are the priority areas for the initiative. One is healthy communities. One is economic and community development. One is educational opportunities. And the fourth is civil and immigrant rights. These are the four topic areas that we work on. Within each of these topic areas, there are cross-cutting priorities. There's data. I'm not going to talk about too much about data, but it's clearly very important. Language access, very important. Workforce diversity, which is what I'm here to tell you about, and capacity building. I think they're all linked together. It's a nice way to show you that we can't really separate them. They're all very connected. So I'm going to switch over to data a little bit. And one of the things that I'll tell you is that this is not a comprehensive data. I'm not giving you everything there is to know about workforce diversity and AA and HPI. I'm also going to focus a lot on medical doctors, physicians, not because I think they're the only or the most important group, but they're the one group that actually has the best available data that I can show you. So first thing first, there is very little reliable national data for our healthcare workforce with disaggregation by subgroup. So if you ask the questions that people have been asking up here, you know, how many Pacific Islanders, how many Chinese, how many Vietnamese, it's very hard to find that information if it exists at all. There's also, for me, very importantly, little reliable data for bilingualistic competence. The number that's been thrown around by the Asian American Association for Medical College is that 22% of medical students in this country are Asian American, and they're probably mostly Asian Americans. But the question that I have in comeback is how many of them actually speak the language that they come from the culture they come from. And I can tell you that I teach them, and they come to my practice, and I wouldn't trust them with my patients. And not that they're very good, but they won't be able to talk to my patients. So 22% is one of those numbers that's very problematic. Because they won't be able to take care of the populations. I went and did a quick look at to see whether or not the states actually collected disaggregate data, and I'm not picking on any state. These are the ones I just were able to find easily. New York, they list them by API. They don't break them down any further than that. And in Texas, they list them by Asians and API. I'll show you California in a minute, because that's the one where I'm actually using some of this. So the good news with the Affordable Care Act is that everyone's going to get access to care. The bad news is who's going to give it to them. So this is a slide from the AAMC looking at the patient care physicians. Again, just looking at doctors only. And at the bottom, the black line, you can see there, we're already in a shortage. Basically, particularly for primary care field, people who are going to see you, talk to you before they send you off to the specialist. We were, in 2008, we're at 7,400 in terms of our shortage. Just because of the population growth alone, by 2020, we'd be 64,000 doctors short. However, because of the Affordable Care Act, basically bringing another 20% or so of the population into care, we're going to actually have 91,000 short on doctors. And a lot of these doctors who are short, I mean, we're running shy on, it's going to be people we need to work in underserved communities and so on and so forth. So this is going to be disproportionate. This points out the need that we need a different care model. We can't just rely on doctors alone. We need other ancillary health services, nurses, patient navigators, community health workers, health coaches, all kinds of different ways of approaching this problem, because you can't make up that 91,000 in the next 5 or 10 years. It takes years and years and years to get a whole cohort of medical students through, and so this is not going to happen if we rely on only doctors. I will violate my rule of not presenting non-disaggregate data just to show you this data on U.S. physicians from the AAMC. 12.8% of physicians are Asians. NHPI is not listed on here, probably because they won't make it in terms of the numbers. In terms of who are the doctors, again, this is, I think, from AAMC data. Predominantly Indian, Pakistani, and Chinese. There are some Vietnamese, Korean, Japanese, and Filipino. There's a group of other Asian. I think this is because they may just have marked something else they didn't want to mark. I can't imagine that there are other non-other Asian groups in here, like Cambodians or Laotians are in that. They may be in that group, but not predominantly in that number. My colleague Kevin Grumbach at UCSF did this study for the California Medical Board, where they survey all the doctors who are licensed there. And so this is a study that was done in 2008. And what you see here is a list of different Asian ethnicity, Chinese, I'm going to read across, Chinese, Indian, Korean, Filipino, Japanese, Vietnamese, Pakistani, Cambodian, Samoan, and Laotian Hmong. That's all we're going to read across from left to right. And then the two different color scheme, the darker scheme is for people who are graduates from U.S. medical school, and the lighter color scheme is for international medical graduates. So it's just a few take-home lessons. You know, very few physicians are Samoan, Cambodian, or Hmong, Laotian ethnicity. And this is California, so you have high populations of these patients. They're just not there. Large proportions of ANHPI physicians are international medical graduates. This is, you know, to me, both an opportunity and a danger because, you know, IMGs are great. They speak the language. You can be pretty sure that when you hire an IMG person, they're going to speak the language they come from. But with the Affordable Care Act and the way that it's structured around systems changes, a lot of these IMGs are practicing in solo practice or small groups, and they may not be able to make it through this huge change without making some huge changes in the way they practice medicine and conduct their business. So there's a danger here that these IMGs may drop out, or anecdotally, I've heard people say, I'm 55 years old, I'm just hanging on for two more years, I'm going to retire. You know, that kind of stuff, and then your community won't have the people to take care of them. The other thing about this survey that I thought was really good was minority physicians are much more likely than white physicians to practice in medically underserved and poor communities. So we don't just want to bring them in because it's some kind of, you know, proportional issue. We want to bring them in because these are the people who are committed to going back and taking care of the people that from the communities they come from. One more slide on physician data, and this is it's California. This is looking at medical school students. And the only big take-home messages here is Filipinos in particular are very underrepresented among physicians, at least in the medical school, but also I've shown you data that they're underrepresented as far as physicians. And then, you know, this is California data. This is all the University of California medical schools. So actually the University of California has a charge to provide the healthcare service professionals for the state of California, and there were no Native Hawaiians or Samoan student for 4 years in all the University of California Medical School. Now, we can think about all the potential reason why that is and think about how to do that, but there is no explanation here except the ones that you already have in your mind. Let's just switch over to the healthcare workforce plan from HHS. So, Daphne mentioned this. The HHS has a really wonderful plan for AAPI. The four goals are there. Number two is data collection. Number three is healthcare workforce. And then Native Hawaiian Pacific Islanders goal number four. And I'm going to just focus on goal number three here. So why do we want to do this? I think this goes without saying in this group. Diversifying, strengthening the healthcare workforce is a central component of addressing racial and ethnic health disparities. The initiative went to Ohio, and the people in Ohio said we would drive an hour or 2 hours. We would go to Philadelphia from Ohio to get access to a doctor who spoke our language. Okay, that's how hard it is in places where it's not concentrated like it is in California, for example. We need a robust healthcare workforce to address the diverse needs. And we need to develop creative strategies about how to encourage our youth to choose career paths in healthcare. And then we should definitely prioritize efforts to increase bilingual and bicultural health workforce, including non-traditional approaches such as peer educators and health leaders. The HHS is a very big agency. They have a lot of people working on issues with AAPI and healthcare workforce, but I'm going to focus only on three. HRSA, Health Resources and Services Administration, Office of Minority Health, and then SAMHSA as an example of one of the agencies that's carrying out an integrated plan. So I stole these slides, Alec, from HRSA. So if they're wrong, it's not my fault. Workforce planning and assessment. So HRSA actually really has given this a lot of thought. And these are actually not AAPI specific activities, but just, you know, they are thinking about workforce and diversity. National Healthcare Workforce Commission is established to develop a national strategic plan. the National Center for Healthcare Workforce and Analysis to provide the data that we need to understand what this current situation is, what the demand is going to be, and what the supply is going to be so we can at least plan for the future. And HRSA also make grants to states for workforce planning and implementation. So each state, hopefully, is doing their own assessment of what their needs are. Again, a lot of the states will not be doing API assessment, so you need to work with them on that. Can I have 2 more minutes? Or I can stop.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. HRSA expands access to healthcare by investing $12.5 billion in the community health centers, as Alex sort of mentioned, and the National Health Service Corps. National Health Service Corps, there's a huge loan repayment program so that people can go back and practice in their communities. There is a significant program expansion in the National Health Service Corps. There are a bunch of other different sort of activities that HRSA is doing to ensure that the healthcare workforce is more appropriate for the communities. They've been funding Centers of Excellence programs, so find out if there's one in your area. And then they're working very closely with ANAPC. How many of you heard of ANAPCs? Okay, so if you don't know what ANAPC are, you should learn, find out. These are Asian American, Native American, Pacific Islander serving institutions, so colleges are designated this, and they have access to certain kinds of funds. So if your institution is not, you may want to ask them about it. I'm going to skip through the class only because most of you probably already know about the class standards. They're basically being revised this year, and so I don't want to talk about them until the new version comes out. But basically, you know, holding people up to a higher standard of providing culturally appropriate care. SAMHSA has been working with a lot of different agencies to increase the supply of mental health providers, which is a real big problem. I have the hardest time getting people to see a counselor in their language. You can imagine how hard that might be, and we need more of those. They worked together with National Asian American Pacific Islander Mental Health Association to convene a summit to come up with a blueprint for integrated care. I'm going to skip through the Pacific Islanders' activities. And ANAPC, again, is just to mention that there is this mechanism to create a pipeline for the healthcare workforce. So you want to get people in at college level so they can be prepared to go on to professional schools, whether it's nursing or medical or what other field they want to go into. I'll skip through the employment issue. And then just to conclude, I feel that the Affordable Care Act and the HHS Action Plan to reduce racial and ethnic health disparities are just unprecedented opportunities to improve the health of our community. Increasing the healthcare workforce and its cultural competency to address our health is an important priority for the administration and HHS, and I hope to be back here in 4 years to show you how far we've come. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tung. And he really means it. So she and I very much are interested in hearing from you what the work of the Commission and the White House Initiative on APIs can do to serve the community, and it's specifically the health community here in the room today. So let us know. We have our contact as well, too. I'd like to just open up for Q&A. We have about 15 minutes, and okay.
Advice to further this desire, because the desire is there. We just feel that the resources are not. Well, thank you for coming. It's always good to see a medical student at public health. It's wonderful. The good news is you're always going to be a pioneer. It's both the challenge and the opportunity. You're always going to be at the head. You're going to be the one creating the solution because these are the problems and no one else has dealt with this and you have to deal with it. A PAMSA, I think, could help you with that. You can be more creative about your lessons. Instead of having a face-to-face, you know, if you have, particularly when you work with small populations, it's hard to come up with the manpower to address in one particular place. So think more creatively about these kinds of training opportunities and even get a grant to implement it. You know, technology is all over the place. You can learn how to speak a language without even speaking in person. So just a practical piece of advice. But I think this is the right thing. The other thing is, I also say that it's important to just get yourself exposed to the language. Go to your community organization that does that and hang around with them. Offer to work with them and learn, you know, how they talk. But it's a big challenge.
Great. Next question. Yes. Great. Thank you for those comments. Anyone want to respond?
No? I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we collect the data, and then a bunch of us sitting in the ivory tower, like, you know, the communities have access to it. I think it would be more than just, I think it, PIRSA and NIH would have to work on this, and we also need to work on it from the community point of view, pushing for access. The great model for this is the California Health News Survey. I love the California Health News Survey because only do they collect disaggregated data. Anyone can go and ask questions about their community immediately. You get an answer within 2 minutes, and you know how to use the internet. So that's the kind of access we need.
So, certainly. I think that. This administration has been really progressive in data transparency. I will say that if you're interested in federal data, you can access it through the Freedom of Information Act, and each of the agencies has a way that you can contact them. And we can talk more in this. And I'm so glad you're here because actually, I was a student of yours a few years back when I was in graduate school. So it's great. I think it's nice to see Dr. Mays is doing much work and with a lot of different population groups. And I don't want to make this session out to be just for Asian American Native Pledges to the Commons. I think a lot of our issues around data access, data segregation, and interpretation of information goes across the board for all of our population groups.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Dr. May, for your question. I certainly concur with you on the issue of data access. The issue of the common response I've received is confidentiality. Data is restricted, and the federal agencies have invested in these data restricted centers. I'm very fortunate that I'm affiliated with an institution that has it. We have these restricted centers either in the basement of the building I operate out of or down the hall from where my office is. But it still does not, you know, it's not enough. And, you know, there is a lot of that concern expressed even by the community that, you know, they feel there's this interviewer burden, they've been overstudied, people are coming in and collecting information and they're not reaping the benefits of that investment. And I think the fact that these data were collected with tax dollar money, it belongs to the people and it needs to work. And the systems need to be in place so that that data works and for all involved. I also appreciate your issue, the concern you raised with the lack of baseline data in the U.S. Associated Pacific Islands. I mean, here we are, the 21st century, a country like the U.S., and there isn't a national health interview survey for any of the territories or the freely associated states. Now, I'm hoping that this model can be replicated because it did work for the Pacific Islander communities here. It was done. The amount of money that was spent, I mean, the return is far greater. It is robust. I didn't share the slide with you, but when you look at the sample, five-year age interval of our random adult sample, and you mirror it to the 2009 National Health Interview Survey, it's almost identical. So the methods that are used for our national surveys do apply even to numerically small populations. It's having that political will, investing, training the capacity, and making it work. But thank you. It is, and as for me, so this data set will become available. It is in keeping with the University of Michigan Institute for Social Research policy, where we do have an archiving unit that's part of the Institute for Social Research, and all these national surveys that my colleagues and I are responsible for eventually get archived through NACDA and becomes publicly and internationally available.
Great.
So I think I just have one more comment about that. And I actually do understand the limitations, especially with the dissemination of data, because we always talk about collecting data and we should do it. And so part of the advocacy work that we're doing in Washington, D.C. is what are some opportunities to work collectively with the administration to release this data? I know that NCHS had their conference, and one of the questions was, you do this data collection, but we never see it. And so I think for us, really understanding who the key administration players are, and if those individuals aren't cooperative, we always have the congressional route. I know that the Congressional Asian Pacific American Caucus is really pushing this idea of data collection and data dissemination because we need useful, relevant materials. And so in the health equity bill, there's actually a whole section really around what are some ways to skirt HIPAA, well, not skirt, but change HIPAA in a way that makes it relevant for our community. And we always know that when we get Congress involved and put pressure on the administration, and this administration has been very good, but maybe in a not-so-friendly administration, using congressional action, and Congresswoman Christensen is really good about really pushing it, especially with her role as being the very first delegate on the Energy and Commerce Committee, which has jurisdiction over public health. So.
Great. Any other questions? Comments? Yes.
Research that's looking at some of the social determinants of health that, you know, you can provide recommendations around eating habits or exercise or taking your meds, but if you don't have those factors outside the clinical walls that reinforce those behaviors or provide access to those things, it's very difficult to see the outcomes you want to see. But I can say that our health centers are certainly leveraging their other resources outside of the clinical wall to help kind of shape an environment that's more conducive to behavior that will help to see better clinical outcomes.
The gentleman back here.
Can I just provide a quick answer from a predominantly Native Hawaiian, represented by a Native Hawaiian serving FUHC? That's exactly what Alex said, is that, you know, our people, our population, which is 67% Native Hawaiian, is generally very pleased with the care that they receive. But the problem is that there's very much barriers, for example, health literacy, poverty, just time, distance. There's all kinds of barriers to people not prioritizing necessarily or being able to follow through on those recommendations. I mean, people, certainly, there's also I don't know if it's a cultural thing, but people generally don't want to say, no, I'm not going to do that. You know, you're the doctor or the nurse practitioner, and they'll tell you, yeah, sure, that's what I want to do, I want to lose weight, and, you know, then you see them even if you're in town, and they're like, you know, eating their family to be. And it's not necessarily because they disrespect you, it's just because there's a reality between us as middle or upper middle class people being able to afford healthy food, for example, or it's being available, and the reality of not knowing if you actually are going to be able to eat the next meal.
Okay, I know that we're running out of time. I saw two more. So two quick comments here. Great, thank you.
Anecdotal,
they're not thinking about it because it's such a big problem for them to change their practice significantly. One of the things that they'll need to do is figure out, you know, do they join an accountable care organization? Do they network with other physicians? That's actually a big issue right now. How do you link all these doctors who are used to being individual practitioners together? Because that is a model that API can use, at least in the community, which I'm familiar with. These are challenges. I wouldn't say that this is a negative so much as it's a potential challenge. And if we don't provide them with the right support, then you may turn around and you have a bunch of patients who then you don't have doctors to give the right cultural and linguistic appropriate care.
Great, thank you. We'll let Elena ask the last question.
Well, I just want to thank you all, the panel, for doing this. And I want to make a plug for Karina, our membership chair, who basically would love to invite you to become members of the Pacific Islander Caucus. I had a last speed round question, and that is, as you told us what you wanted to do in terms of accomplishing your Nobel Prize, if you could actually give us, in 15 seconds each, your call to action for each of us to inspire us as we leave from this session.
Okay, why don't we go down this way? So, Tone?
I did it already. Why not be a health insurance exchange commissioner and get a meeting with them? And then get a friend, a child, a student to join you in the health care.
Great. Alex?
Be very active in civic engagement.
Okay. Sella?
put the interests of the people first.
I would say vote next week.
Next Tuesday. I want to thank our distinguished panelists, Tung, Alex, Sella, and Paulo, and really want to thank the Asian Pacific Islander Caucus for Public Health, the Health Equity, Are We Making Progress Organizing Committee, and all of you for coming today and engaging in this lively discussion. And hopefully we have moved the conversation forward, but as we all know, there's a lot of work to do in our community, so much need out there, and we want to make sure that all of you are engaged and involved. So please take action. Join the Asian Pacific Islander Caucus for Public Health at www.apicaucus.org. and the Social Determinants of Health listserv as well. So thank you so much for joining us today.